Well, without further ado, I want to invite you to give a very, very warm Highfields welcome to Graham Daniels. So let's give him a very warm welcome. First thing first, get the mic on, my man. Get the mic on, Dano.
Keep talking.
So this is Graham Daniels. Dano to his friends. We've been friends for a good while. He's a Llanelli boy.
I am. I put the mic on in a minute. Sorry.
So Dano's got all sorts of interesting things about him, and we're going to find out about Dano and about his faith. I think tonight, what we're calling it, from football to faith. Is that right? Is that what we're calling tonight? From football to faith. And maybe this coming Tuesday evening, as Wales kind of take on the possibility of going to the Euros, there'll be lots of faith taking place that evening too. You're a strong kind of Welshman, never left Wales, although you have been out of Wales for a long time. So now you're in Cambridge. Tell us what you're doing.
Yes. Well, we've been in Cambridge for 41 years, so we've been there an awfully long time. An awfully long time. I wouldn't normally say awfully, but once you said Cambridge, I thought I'd better say something like that. Well, we moved there. Michelle, my wife, and I were at uni here.
Yep.
And then we moved to Cambridge straight after. Well, I moved straight after graduating, so I went there to play football.
Yeah. Okay. And Cambridge United is the place where you spend all your time now, a lot of your time.
Yes.
Director.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow. You know, if it was director of Man United or something, you'd go, yeah, fair play. Director of Cambridge United.
So what does that involve? Must be interesting.
Yeah. So the backstory is the club was in trouble. I mean, it's probably an insight into professional football because...
League One. League One, yep.
So the club was in trouble, as often clubs do in the lower leagues, in the EFL. And so I had a friend who's Cambridge born and bred, but lives in the States and has lived there forever, really. And he was willing to buy the club. So really, that's what happened. He bought the club and it just needed reorganising, really, and restructuring. So I was part of the process of trying to... I looked after the football side, trying to restructure the football side. And then somebody who was a proper businessman came on the board, two of us, and he looked after the business. And that was around Christmas 2017.
Yeah.
And it probably took three or four years, really, to get some order and shape and then appoint a new CEO and a new director of football, as it were, to take those roles permanently.
Yeah.
And so that's that. So we're all right, you know, we're... What you get, I don't know what happens in other sports. I certainly don't know what happens in rugby. But what happens is once the salaries and the costs are agreed on contracts for the season, around September, each club will get a league table, as it were, in our league, 24 teams. And then your team will be listed and your budget. You'll see everybody else's budget, but not their names. Okay. But of course, you can work out who's who. So actually, that probably drives quite a lot of how the business works because, say, your sixth bottom budget, pretty much is what we've been the last few years, sixth, seventh bottom, four go down. So, of course, you can overachieve. That's sport, isn't it? But fundamentally, you know roughly who you're competing with to survive in that, in our case. So that's how it works.
Yeah. Enjoy it?
It drives me crazy, yeah. Well, it would, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
It would. It's the world I've lived in all my life.
Yes.
So in that sense, like everybody else, the world you're in is the world you know. So you can't really say you're a fan. You know, I can be a fan, I don't know, the Scarlets, isn't it? Because it's not my job and it's home and I'm a fan. It's work.
Yes.
But it's where I think God put me. And therefore, it's absolutely vital that it's pivotal to everything I do in life and all my relationships. Some people at my football club will say, go to church, and some will say they're a Christian. But for most people, they won't necessarily have come across many people who do have a relationship with God through Christ. And so I've spent my life in that environment, really.
Yeah, fantastic. So, but that's not your main job. You've got two jobs, haven't you? So the other job is this role with Christians in Sport, heading that up. Tell us a bit about that and what that involves for you.
Well they've been simultaneous, really.
Okay, yeah.
When I left here and went to Cambridge, I wouldn't have said I was a Christian. Okay. And I'm sure we'll come back to that. But sure. I became a Christian there. But I was still playing. That was my job. And so really, through my 20s, I was trying to work out this job of playing football, which I worked out. I was okay at it, but not very good. It's a fact. So I was at Cardiff City as a boy. So the youth teams and the reserves, never played in the first team. Transferred to Cambridge, played. But when you play regularly, of course, you actually work out how good other people are and how good you are. Mm. So actually I was all right, but I wasn't that good. Mm. And I certainly wouldn't have played at the top level. So you start thinking about what life's about and what you're going to do. And then I became a Christian, but I realised I just knew absolutely nothing of substance about Christianity. Hmm. So in my later 20s, I did some studies so I could catch up. And effectively, therefore, Christians in Sport is almost like it's a verb as much as a noun, really. I've been a Christian in Sport since I was a young man, and I still am. Hmm. It's probably one thing worth saying about it, which brings a bit of oxygen to my ramblings, which is I was baptised in my middle-ish 20s at Cambridge, and it was in the local paper, and a bloke showed up at my football club a few days later, and he was very, very posh, and he clearly didn't play football at all because somebody said after training, there's a really posh guy in reception waiting for you. So reception is porter cabin at Cambridge United. So I went to the porter cabin. I don't know what you call it. Reception is the porter cabin. So I went to the porter cabin. And surely enough, there's a bloke there called Andrew Wingfield Digby. So that's pretty posh. And he's 6 foot
there are not
two.
Many of those in Fletchley.
None in Fletchley. And there was a little hyphen in there. So he says, hello. He said, I gather you're a Christian. I said, yes, I am. He said, I can't keep doing that. He said, did I know there were other Christians playing professional football? Hmm. Now, I'd been a Christian for about 6 or 8 months, such thing. So, of course, every Saturday or Tuesday night, whenever you're playing, you see people that you know. And I'd ask, you know, I'd say, anyone a Christian at your club? And nobody knew anyone. And I only did that for a while. And then I said, does anyone go to church at your club? So I couldn't find anyone. And so this man says to me, there are Christians. So 92 clubs. And I think, well, you must know what you're talking about. I said, are you absolutely certain? He said, I know them. So I said, oh, fantastic. So now I'm excited, you know, because I'm thinking, great, there's nobody else. I thought was the only one. So I say to him, great. I said, well, how many? And he says, four. And he's had this charity called Christians in Sport since 1980. It's 1984. I'm thinking, who pays his wages? You know, because it's like nobody. But at least there's four. So I think, oh, fantastic. I say, who are the four? And he names three. I say, who's the fourth? He says, you. So it was actually...
Wow.
Well, fair play, you got that out of my brain there, because it was the first time I ever thought... So it was a long time ago, right? It was 40 years ago. So it was the first time I ever thought, gosh, what would it look like if people started telling other people who are proper, competitive and elite sports people that you can be a Christian and an athlete and a coach? So I guess that's where it all came from, yeah.
Fantastic. So your time with Christians in Sport, you're heading up that charity and you're connecting with elite sports men and women as well as part of that?
Yeah, there are, over the years, thousands of young people, sort of 11 through 17, have been through the camps because they're pretty competitive girls and boys who come. Mm. Otherwise, you'd get bored with it because you play a lot through the day. It's quite competitive. And then in the top sports-rated universities in the country. There have always been Christians in sport groups. And, of course, as is obvious here from Highfields, the link with camps from this church and with university workers, if anyone comes to Cardiff, we encourage them to come here pretty much all the time. So those links mean that over generations, there are obviously many, many grown men and women now with their own families who have been part of that. And then there's a little niche bit. I'll give you an example. Would be if you're in the top 120 tennis players in the world, male and female, but you're outside the top 32, you're probably net about $80,000 a year. Now, it's a lot of money by my standard, but to net that, you've got to travel 7 to 8 months a year on the tour. You barely get past the first couple of rounds. You're in a hotel as long as you're in the competition, and they play a flight from where you've been to the competition. That's your money and your prize money. Mm. If you want a physio, a coach, you're all self-employed, so you pay for that. So there are young women and young men on the track and field, on the tennis tours, for example, who spend their lives travelling the world, and everybody thinks it's super glam because they're a professional tennis player or a sprinter or a distance runner. But the reality is that's their world. It's a good, you know, they love it. But you need somebody there, somebody who can help you think about your Christian faith, run effectively a small church service, do a Bible study. Loads of people come to those who wouldn't say they're a Christian, but there's a community around that. So there's that niche end of the work of Christians in sport, both travelling on the global circuit and in team sports in this country, big team sports. That's a niche area that really is probably it's a USP that it would be hard for a local church to do for all the obvious reasons.
Great. Let's go back a bit and let's hear about how you came to faith yourself. So you alluded to that a bit this morning, but love to hear that for yourself. You know, from you're starting out, you're mad about football. When does faith come into the story?
Well, it comes into the story because Joan Eileen Daniels, my esteemed mother, who's now in heaven, she was amazing. I had great parents. Actually, I was an adopted child. What happened was my mum had married her husband, her first husband, when he was dying of cancer, because I didn't know him, in their 20s. And he died. And then she married my father when she was 40-odd. And it was his first marriage.
Wow.
And posh people keep appearing in this story. Because in Soar Baptist Church in Llwynhendy, near Llanelli, my parents were going to church. It would have been a kind of broad, typical, traditional Welsh-speaking church. So they might not have been wholly clear sometimes what the Christian message was. But a new minister came who was a well-spoken Welshman who'd come from London. And his wife came along and she said to my mother, Joan, you haven't got a family. Have you ever thought of having children? She said, well, I'm 40-something or other. I can't. And she said, oh, yes, you could. Because this woman was the chairwoman of the Baptist Union Children's Society.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing.
And so as I get older, I never used to talk about this, only because my mum and dad were still alive. And I have a sister who's not biological sister, but adopted as well. She sought out to look for her family with my parents' blessing. Amazing. I never did.
Amazing.
Just different ways, isn't it?
Amazing.
But when they passed away, sometimes I talk about it because I meet families who for different reasons, can't have children.
Yeah.
And every time I see somebody who adopts children, I think, what a chance you've given somebody in life.
Amazing.
So Tom and Joan, that's a long way around, isn't it? Tom and Joan brought me in. And sometimes I'm in wonder that, you know, at this stage of my life, I've been a Christian for 40 years, and you think, well, the providence of it all, you know, just going to Llanelli and... So I was born in Farnborough. I can't bear it. It's horrible. I know, I get such stick for it. There's a thing in Wikipedia about footballers and it says I was born in Farnborough, so I can't hide it anymore. I try to hide that.
It's all a mask.
Oh, it's terrible. So my mum was amazing because she prayed for me, and I'll pause then so you can come back in because you wouldn't expect this bit necessarily. And when she passed away, her heart was pretty weak. Well, it was 15 years ago at least now. So when she passed away, my sister, who's a nurse, told me at Christmas time, when we went with us three small children at the time, or young children, my sister said, she called me aside, she said, listen, before you go, when if you come back at half term in February, I don't think Mum will be here. So her heart's very weak. So I don't think she'll make it till then. So she said, you must, you know, note that before you go. So I put all my kids in the car. Michelle, my wife, and the kids in the car, as we always would, and parents wave goodbye. And then I thought, I'll have to go back in. But I didn't want to do it in front of the kids, you know, because I thought they might be upset by it. I didn't tell them. So I went back in the kitchen. So anyone who can experience a sort of Welsh, you know, South Wales home now, I go back in and I say, she's in the kitchen, tiny kid. I said, now then, Mum, I'm off now. She said, there we are, so long. I said, no, I'm off now, though. She said, I know, good. Good boy. I'll give you a kutch. I've given you one. I said, but I'm off now. And you know I love you, don't you? You know you're brilliant. And she said, oh, don't be soft now. She said, don't be soft now. Come on, off you go. I said, well, you are. I said, I'm very grateful. So I went to the car and I jumped in. I thought I'd keep the kids away from, but I couldn't, you know. I cried in the car. But the nice bit, I know that's a sad story, but watch this. She did pass away, and I didn't get there in time. I drove from Cambridge when she went to hospital. And when I got home, my mum had a chair like this with a little table next to it. And when I got there, the table there and the chair, I said to my dad and my sister, can I look at Mum's notebook? He said, of course you can. So I opened her notebook, and in really rubbish writing, wobbly writing, that morning when they called the ambulance, she was in her chair, and she'd written two things. I was 38 years of age. The first one said to my dad, Tom, get sugar puffs for Graham. I'm 38. We used to go home. My wife would go mad because you're trying to teach your children to eat properly and they're just a massive sugar puffs for my mother. Get sugar puffs for Graham. And number two, she'd written, in this world we will have many troubles, but take heart. I have overcome the world. It's the last thing she ever wrote down.
Amazing.
She was class.
Yeah.
She was class. Now, I know you wouldn't expect me to go there.
No, wow.
But I just thought, sometimes I speak of my sporting friends and their influence. But sometimes parents need to hear, don't they? The influence of the parents on people who come to faith much later, yes. Like me,
yes.
Is immense, and it's never forgotten.
Those prayers, not wasted.
Never forgotten.
So this, you know, so Graham, the youngster, growing up, you know, godly mother, but to what degree you're engaging is another thing. It's all about football for you.
It was. So, you could only play rugby at school, really, you know, rugby and cricket, so you couldn't play football in my school in the 70s. But when you were in what's now year 11, you were allowed to just about play for the sort of year 12 and year 13 team. So I was allowed to play in year 12. My dad was not happy because it was football, which was, you know, the wrong sport, but I played it. But it wasn't very hard. It wasn't very hard back in the day to get in the Welsh schools team because everybody played rugby if they were any good. So I got in the Welsh schools football team. It was a bit of a shock for my school and, in fact, an embarrassment because they only wanted rugby boys. But that was a sort of open door, really, because through playing... you know, the schoolboy games, obviously people are watching. And then I signed for Cardiff City a schoolboy.
Okay.
So that's how that got going, football.
Okay, so then Cambridge.
Yeah.
How does... How do you come to faith in Jesus Christ? I mean, give us the kind of story of that.
Yeah, so what it was, as a sporty little boy... I would dream, my dream was to play football for the best team possible. I had a cousin called Rob, who Liverpool were in the FA Cup final in 71 against Arsenal, and he gave me a Chinese burn. Do you know what that is?
Yeah, yeah.
I know, it's very cruel. He gave me a Chinese burn because I wouldn't support Liverpool, so I did, to avoid the Chinese burn. And then I ended up a Liverpool fan for the rest of my life. It's a scar, and it still hurts. It's scar tissue. But because of that, I wanted to be a footballer. And it was quite important. So when I actually did, you know, the Welsh schools thing and then Cardiff, I was thinking, wow, this is mad. But then it sort of went further. I wanted to leave school, but I had a brilliant head teacher. It was the old grammar school system. Mm. I just had this most amazing head teacher in a sort of, you know, working class industrial town who went to see my mother and father and said, no, you mustn't leave school because most people who play football don't last. Amazing man, you know, 600 boys in his school. He went to see my mum and dad and said, and he spoke to the football club. Mm. So I used to come here in the holidays and the weekends.
Yeah.
And then I came to university here, so I could combine them all.
Okay.
But then I transferred to Cambridge, and I think if you look it up today in the Guinness Book of Records, I think it's still there, because in 1983 I arrived at Cambridge United in the Championship in the year 83-84. And between October 83 and March 84, which is a long time, isn't it? It's a long time, you know. It's a long time, 6 months. Cambridge United played 31 games, league and cup, drew 4 and lost 27. And I played in all of them. But one of those...
What position did you play?
Sub, mostly. I was a left winger. But here's the answer to the actual question was, my boyhood hero, which old people will remember but youngsters won't, was a man called Kevin Keegan, who was had been the England captain. He was a superstar. And he was in the last year of his playing career at Newcastle United. They were top of the Championship. Obviously, we were bottom. And we were playing Newcastle away. It was great, because I used to speak to my parents on a Friday night. So we were in a hotel in Newcastle. So I phoned my dad. I don't phone my dad, because it never worked like that. I phoned home. My mum would answer. She would talk for 30 minutes in Welsh. And then she'd say at the end, there we are, your father's here. And my dad would come on. He'd say, all right. Say, all right. Good, Dad. All right, yeah, good. He said, good. Who you got tomorrow then? Newcastle. Oh, are you up there? Yes. Good boy. All the best. Your mother's here. Back tomorrow. But on this occasion, my dad says, I said, Newcastle. Ooh, he said, Newcastle, Keegan's not playing, is he? I said, yeah, he is, Dad, yeah, he is, because he was his last season. So it was amazing. Wow. It was amazing. So we played there. I mean, I will tell you, it was funny, the manager. You know sport, coaches, management. It's 2:45, we're playing Newcastle United away. The ground's packed, they're top of the league. We haven't won for ages. And at 2:50, the manager comes in. He goes, right, everybody sit down. He says, I know these are top of the league, but they're not as strong as they look. And we're all going, shut up. And he says, they're a bit vulnerable in midfield. And like, they all played for England and Scotland. So anyway, we played the game. We're 1-0 down 20 minutes. We're 2-0 down half time. But they start showing off a little bit, you know, tippy-tappy, because they wear rubbish, and they start pausing, and then we get stuck in a little bit, and they start getting a bit jumpy, 2-0, tricky score. And then we've got a boy called Robbie Cook, who's a right-winger, and the ball went to him, and he did something I hadn't seen him do all season. He beat the left-back, fantastic, got to the byline, and he actually managed to get a cross in. So I just got to the far post as a cross came, and like it bobbled, hit me on the thigh, hit the bar, hit the post, but it went in. So I've scored at Newcastle. So it was like madness. It was like all your dreams came true at once. I know it's only Cambridge United, but you know you do it all the time down the rec, don't you? You know, Daniel scores, Keegan. There it is. You know, it's happened. Here's what happens next. On the Tuesday night, we're playing. We lose, of course. We're playing Brentford away, who are then in the lowest division, not like they are now. In a League Cup type of competition. Okay. Tuesday night, 3,000 fans, Brentford away. And when I went to that game on the bus, I realised, wow, 6 months ago, if you'd have said to me, you're playing Brentford away on a Tuesday night, I'd have given anything, you know, to put the first team shirt on for any football team. And on this Tuesday night, it was an anticlimax. it was an anticlimax. And then I thought of the one person, two or three, but one at the heart of it, a man called Gwion Jenkins, who was captain of rugby and everything at school cricket. And he was a brilliant guy, a very, very good athlete. But he told me about Jesus on a bus on the way to Cowbridge to play cricket once. And I found out after I'd become a Christian, some 6 or 7 years later, his father told me, I went to their home, and the story went like this from his dad. His dad said, on that day, it was a Monday in May when I was in year 10 at school. Gwion had gone home, and his dad said to him, how did the game go today, son? And he said, oh, all right, dad, not bad. He said, get any runs? 95, I think he got. He said, take any wickets? 5. For 23. His dad said, you don't look very happy. And he said, nah, dad. He said, you know, yesterday, this is Monday night, at church yesterday, his dad was a pastor. He said, you talked about the good news of Jesus and how marvellous it is that we get a chance to let other people have an insight into Jesus Christ by just saying something. He said, I realised, dad, I've never told anybody anything once ever in my life at 18 about my Christian faith. So I resolved that I would tell somebody. He says, and then at 5 to 12, one of the boys was sick. So the master of cricket sent me to this classroom of this boy. He always had his kit with him, just in case there was a chance of a game. His name was Graham Daniels. So he said, so I went to get Graham Daniels. We chucked him on the bus. He said he wasn't going to do anything. He didn't bat, and I was long leg or third man. So I didn't do a thing. He said, but on the bus, I thought, ooh, I'll tell him I'm a Christian. So when we were coming out of Cowbridge on the way back to Llanelli, it's about 50 miles, he sat next to me, so a couple of minutes out of Cowbridge, and he says to me, what did I do at the weekend? So I'm 15, 16. I said, well, I played cricket Saturday, nothing Sunday, because in those days there was nothing on. If you didn't go to church, there was nothing on. I wasn't going to church at all. So I said to him, what did you do? He said, well, I played cricket Saturday. On Sunday, I went to church. And before I could stop it was out of my mouth. I looked at him. I said, whoa, does your mother still make you go to church on Sunday? I mean, he was the king of school. He had a beard. Like a man. He was like a man. What's he go to church for? I said, why do you go to church? And he says, he blushed. And he says, I go to church because I followed Jesus. Well, I said to myself, 45 miles to go. I'm stuffed here. Who is this bloke? But as his dad told me the story, he said, his son said to him, Dad, so that was my end of the story. He said, Dad, I tried to tell that boy something about being a Christian. He said, it was useless. He said, he turned away from me, never looked at me again on the way home. I'm never trying that again. I'm never telling anyone I'm a Christian again. It's a waste of time, Dad. And his dad told me that story the summer after the Newcastle-Brentford game.
Wow.
When the only person I could think of on the bus home from Brentford was Gwion Jenkins. What gave him that peace?
Yeah.
He was a good athlete. What gave him that stability? What made him such an authentic bloke, the real deal, and a really good player? So the combination of his sporting excellence and something about he was more than an athlete, and there was something really attractive about him. He thought he'd blown it telling me about his Christian faith, but right through football, right through uni, right through going to Cambridge, when I associated Christianity, when I heard anybody say they were a Christian or read anything, I would think of him, and it was utterly plausible to be a Christian, which in the end meant that I came to a faith of my own.
So what was it that... So this is Gwion's story. This is him. It made sense knowing him. But what triggered for you thinking, okay, that's okay for someone else, but for you, Graham Daniels, to step over the line, I'm a footballer. Yeah, I love this. Yeah. But actually, there's something that needs my first affection. How did that happen?
Well, because I was playing football when I was here, I chose a degree, so I was in the humanities faculty. Okay. So in the first year, back in the day, you could choose three subjects. So I looked for the subject with the fewest lectures, so I could get to Ninian Park every day. I did. I lived in Club Diggs. So I ended up, after my first year, doing a degree in philosophy, which only had four lectures and two seminars a week. So it was class. So I just played football and did a philosophy degree. But the upshot of that was when I moved to Cambridge to play football, I had a lot of time on my hands because I combined the two of them till then. So Michelle, who I married afterwards, later on, we were at university together. She wasn't there. He trained 2 or 3 hours a day. I had loads of time on my hands. So it was the first time in my life I'd been somewhere on my own with space. And I just thought, after that Newcastle game, I'm going to start reading things. So actually, there was a Scripture Union bookshop in Cambridge.
Okay.
So I started going in to get books. And the first book I got was something called Evidence That Demands a Verdict. And of course, because of the philosophy and the claims about it, Christianity clearly isn't empirical. There's no evidence for it. It's a wish. It's made up. I started reading Hard Facts about the resurrection. And thinking, oh my gosh, this narrative is probably accurate. So there's something about the accuracy of it, the truth of it. So that mattered, that it was intellectually coherent. So there was a coherence. Started reading, really, had plenty of time, started reading books. And then, of course, there was the emotional alignment of a Gwion Jenkins who could be a player and a Christian. And the tipping point was really the boys were having a night out. Now, remember now, Joan, you know, my dad became a Christian before he died, but, you know, my mum was the big factor here, looking back. But actually what happened, the boys were having a night out. Back in those days, it doesn't happen now, but if you didn't have a midweek game, everybody would go out partying on Tuesday night. You had Wednesday off, and then you'd put bin liners on Thursday morning under your kit to sweat it off. Which was such nonsense. But because everybody did it, it didn't cost your team. You know, now you'd be finished. But I didn't go out that Tuesday night. I was supposed to go out with all the players. And I was reading my Bible, and I read. I can remember it now. If Christ didn't rise from the dead, your faith is futile. Paul writes to the letter called 1 Corinthians. To a church in Corinth, if Christ didn't rise from the dead, your faith is futile and you're still in your sins. At which point, obviously, I thought, well, what's the reverse of that? If Christ did rise from the dead, your faith is valuable and you don't have sins to account for. And I read that line, I thought, oh my gosh. I mean, that is an empirical claim. I've been reading about the resurrection. There's a link here between the forgiveness of things you've done wrong, that Christ somehow pays for that, and you can have a brand new start. But I thought the man's willing also to say that if it didn't happen, it's nonsense, and give it up. It's a waste of space. It's not true. And at that point, I'd been reading these books, and I put two and two together. I thought, I've got to be a Christian. But I didn't know if I was a Christian. So I went to work on Thursday morning. All the boys were in. And somebody said, you're taffy. Obviously, I was taffy. Where were you Tuesday, Taff? You're waste. Everybody was out but you. I said, I know. I said, I couldn't come. I had something going on. They said, what do you mean you had something going on? You don't know anyone. You haven't got any mates. What do you mean you had something going on? And you know where I found myself? I found myself where Gwion Jenkins was. So I didn't know what to say. So I said, I didn't come out because I've decided to follow Jesus. They all looked at me like that. And someone called the physio, was called Pete Melville, he said, Melv, get yourself out. Pressure's gone to Taffy, his head's gone, he cracked. But he was out. But I didn't know if I was a Christian. And then the following week, after training, somewhere you know very well, I went into the middle of Cambridge, and I was on King's Parade. You could drive a car, which you couldn't now. I was with a pal in a car, going along King's Parade, and I saw a boy who was the boffin of our school, when we were at school, like cleverest boy at school, a bit older than me. Michael Jenkins, his name was. I went, oh, it's Michael Jenkins. I said to my friend, Clarky, stop the car, stop the car. So I jumped out of the car, ran after Jenkins. And I saw it. I shouted his name, Michael, Michael, like a maniac, really. And I saw him turn around and look at me, and I saw him thinking, oh, it's that wretched boy on the school bus. Oh, my word. I mean, I wasn't popular with him. And he said, yes, it is Michael Jenkins. He's doing a PhD now. And he says, yes, it is. He said, it's Graham Daniels, isn't it? I said, it is, Michael. I said, are you still a Christian? And I could see him thinking, oh, he's going to take the mickey out of me. We didn't know each other, just on the school bus, but I knew he was a Christian. And he said, yes, I am. I said, oh, fantastic, because I think I am too, but I need somebody to prove it to me, that I am. So he took me to this tea shop called Auntie's Tea Shop, and we sat down, and he explained what a Christian was to me. I thought, no, I'm right, I am. And he took me to church on Sunday. Fantastic. That was it, I'm off.
Amazing.
I was off.
Wonderful.
It was class. It was class, because it was such a shock to the system. I'd watched religion at a distance. I'd seen, you know, one or two people. When I was here at university, I've never been able to track them down. They said they were getting married straight after uni because they were going out and they just wanted to be together, so they wanted to marry. I remember, you know, I was thinking, boy, what are you doing? What are you talking about? Mm. But they were Christians, and they invited me to a carol service. Mm. And in my final year as an undergrad here, I slipped in after everybody gone in and slipped out before the end. I listened to a talk about Jesus the year before I went off to play football. Mm. So you just don't know what's going on, do you?
Absolutely.
Michael Jenkins, those two. He was brilliant, Michael.
One last question, then we'll have a little break. So the question is, you've touched on, you're now saying you're a Christian. Yeah, I think, yeah, this is me, I'm a Christian now. And the sport has carried on. Roll on the clock to the last several years, if that's okay. So we'll fly over lots of story. There'll be a chance for you to ask some questions if you'd like to in a little while. But I'd love just to kind of give you a chance to share a little bit about what you've been up to more recently. You're still director of football up at Cambridge United, still Christensen Sport, but you've become an academic. And you've done some research yourself in terms of identity and faith in sport, etc. Do you want to kind of explore that a little bit just for a few moments and then we'll have a little break? So just plant some seeds and we can pick that up after the break.
All right. I know, that's weird, isn't it?
Dr. Daniels.
Yeah, thank you very much. That's just weird. Here's what happened.
He asked me to ask him that.
Here's what happened. Somebody said to me, so I'm 61 years of age, and when I was about 53 or 4, somebody said to me, look, you've been a Christian a long time. You work with Christians in sport. Did you know no one's ever researched, proper research, no one's done a PhD on professional athletes who are Christians and made any comparison between their experience and those of people who wouldn't have a Christian faith? Hmm. So I said, and? They said, well, it's very hard to interview professional athletes because nobody can get to them. So even if people wanted to do those interviews, it's a pretty big deal. One, to get access to elite type players, and two, to have them trust you enough that you could ask them anything and get the answers. And then they explained that's how research works and that's what you need to do. So I thought, gosh, it would be fascinating. So I was actually quite compelled by it. And Christians of Sport were very kind and gave me effectively a day a week for 6 years to do it. So I did that. I interviewed 15 players, all of whom had come to faith during their playing career, between the ages of 18 and 33. The oldest was a man called Cyril Regis, who was very famous back in his day. Sadly passed away a few years ago, very young. Gavin Peacock would have been the Chelsea captain. So they were people who I'd known and had really had Bible studies with through the 90s and noughties and 10s. So I did it with them, and so compared the findings of how they dealt with the pressures of elite sport with those of sociologists particularly. So I don't want to bore you, so I could tell you more about that. I could talk about that all night. But the big answers are the following. Number one. No, I'm not going to do it. It'll take too long.
Sure.
Yeah, but I'm going to stop.
It sounds like the kind of impact of Christian faith and, yeah. And a bigger thing going on in my life than the thing right in front of me. I'd love yeah. to explore that. So maybe we'll come back to that, and there's a chance for people to ask some questions if they'd like to. Okay?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. I'm going to do it there.
Fantastic. We're going to just take a pause at this stage.
Just as we're getting ready to get going again, one thing that Graham mentioned in his testimony of how he came to know Jesus Christ for himself was reading the Bible. And maybe you have never done that as a thinking adult. And that would be a really, really good thing to do. And just to grab a gospel, maybe a Mark's gospel, and have a read through and meet Jesus yourself. Now, that's a good thing to do on your own. There's Easter's coming up, and what a great thing to do. But it may be that you would like to do that with someone else. And after Easter, we're running a three-week course just looking at some excellent little themes from the gospel, and we're going to encourage people to come together and discuss that with us. And we're going to see if we can. Abby, maybe you can put up that little video of Hope Explored, which we're running for three Monday evenings after Easter. Can we do that? Thank you.
There are few emotions more powerful than hope. It's a spark inside you that brings a smile to your lips, a light that shows on your face, a feeling that lifts your head and pulls you forward. These days, hope like that often feels hard to come by. Maybe you've experienced your share of disappointments, but real hope is what the Christian faith claims to offer. A joyful expectation for the future, based on true events in the past, which changes everything about my present. Hope Explored is a three-session series for anyone who is looking for a hope worth having. Whatever you do or don't believe, this is your invitation to explore, to discuss, to question, to discover. This is Hope Explored.
So we're going to be starting Hope Explored on the 8th of April, Monday after Easter, in the evening, 7:30, and for the next three Monday evenings. And there'll be opportunities to sign up for that over the course of the week, but make a mental note that Monday evenings in the early part of next term after Easter, that's the chance for you to plug in. We'll talk more about it over the course of the coming week, the coming days as well, but look out for that as well. Well, we're going to switch over to Slido now. So thank you, Dano, for that really, really thoughtful little conversation and Maisie as well, which was lovely to hear from you. Will the Kashakas be making an appearance again sometime this week, perhaps? Maybe not. Yes, Tuesday. Listen, if that was just whetting the appetite, then I just want to get myself down to Tapas and Tunes, which is where Tapas and Kashakas are going to be being done. 7:30, great food. Tomorrow night, Christian, the sports quiz, whether or not you're a Christian. It's not just for Christians, it's and not even for hardcore sports people, just someone who's interested in engaging together with some good questions about sport with some friends. That'd be lovely. Movie night coming up too. But we've got some questions, and the way it works is people can vote up and down the questions. So I see what you see, and I'm going to pick off a few of them from the top. So here's the first one, which is a fun question to do with professional footballers in the Premier League. Do you know if there are many of them? How they live out their faith in that environment? Maybe you've got connections with them. What's it like up there?
There? I don't know much about being up there. it is fantastic at the moment in professional football. So it's very hard now to go into a football club pretty much anywhere in professional football where there aren't a number of Christians. It's kind of pretty normal right across the four divisions.
Is that a lot to do with people coming over to the UK from other countries, I'm guessing?
I think it's to do with probably, at least two things humanly.
Okay.
One, a lot of people in the 90s and noughties were really respected professional footballers. I named two earlier, for example. They became Christians. So what happened was, even if they're teammates, lots of those teammates of those players are now managers or sporting directors at all levels of football.
David Moyes?
That's David good. Moyes.
West Ham.
Would be one. And West Ham, naturally. But because lots of the people who became a Christian were deeply respected as pros and as people by their peers. Now, out of that group of people in the 90s and noughties, lots of those people are managers and coaches in football clubs. So when they hear somebody's a Christian, it's not a big deal when a young player's a Christian, whereas go back 20 years and it was pushed away. So that's changed football. Overseas players have changed football. And the culture is a third factor. It's very hard to make fun of people's life choices in so many ways in contemporary culture, including Christianity, actually. So it's worked an advantage. So yes, there are lots. And two more things worth saying. There are a couple of... there's one group of footballers which has about 400 people in a WhatsApp group across the Football League. And a super guy called John Bostock, who you could Google and look up. He runs something called Ballers in God. And they have hundreds of people in that group. And they meet weekly online. And then there's a coaches group on Wednesday mornings, typical day off in football, 9:30 to 10:30. That'll be my group, I guess. You know, the boys who I know, 40 and 50, and they manage clubs and coach clubs. So they meet on the typical players day off for an hour for an online meeting Bible study. So there's a lot. Now, I will say one more thing, which is we're very careful about naming names. And once I tell you, it'll be pretty obvious. If somebody's 23 years old and a Premier Division footballer, male or female, because both games are big now, if we start touting them to give their testimony, often these boys and girls are unchurched, often, not always, but they know very little, really, when they become a Christian. And so you're exposing them to huge pressures when you say, well, we'll make a film of this 24-year-old who plays for Spurs, who's a Christian. Social media means they talk a lot themselves. But if I'm ever asked, a Christian supporter ever asked, could we have this famous woman, 25-year-old woman who's a top, top name, well-known, what we say is we can't help you with it. If we have anything to do with it and we can find a church where we have a part to play in this, we'll find a church where, as it would be here, where we'd say, look after him or her. Don't expose them too early. They don't know anything. Protect them a bit. So that's how it works.
Yeah, fantastic. Great. One thing which is great about Slido is it's very democratic, and what the people want to know, I got to ask.
I have no idea what's coming there.
How many keepy-uppies can you do with a tennis ball?
Well, see, that is a trick question, because I know the moment I say how many I can do, there's a ball flying out at me. So I'm not sick. I wasn't born yesterday, was I? Two. I can do two. And actually, I spent most of my life playing left back, so I may not be able to do many, but boy, I could kick it a mile. I could smash it out the ground any day
away.
You like.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, the people wanted to know, so there we are.
You're
Maybe we can test it later in the week. You're here for...
We could not.
5 days, yeah. Okay. So, Chris, how does your faith play a role in the business side of football? Obviously, it is big business today, dealing with professional sportsmen, agents, other clubs, etc. Yeah, interesting question. You talked before about kind of integrity as one of those hallmarks as part of that research. I guess that comes into it.
Yeah. You could push me on this, but because my instinct is to answer, so I'm happy to be pushed back, but my instinct is to answer, well, if you're in any business, you know, any business, integrity is a pretty big deal, isn't it? So telling the truth, not backstabbing people, telling people face to face what's wrong, giving praise where it's due. I mean, you do that in football just as you would, it seems to me anyway, in any other walk of life. Now, once you're inside, the one thing is, obviously, once you're inside a changing room, you know, no one at Liverpool is impressed that another guy in the changing room plays for Liverpool, is he? Because they both play for Liverpool. Are you with me? No one's impressed that somebody plays for Man U or Man City or Arsenal or Spurs if they do as well. So once you're inside a business, no one's impressed by that. So now what are people impressed by? Well, the real deal. I'm not saying I'm the real deal. You want to be the real deal. But that's how you'd go about it. You'd say, Lord, I can't really, you know, I can't depend on my own strengths here, but you're here with me. And I think, Dave, I'd want to say, I'm quite a strong believer that the God who made the universe, you know, 200 billion galaxies, the God who rejoiced in making humanity, as it says in Proverbs 8, you know, he delighted in the world, he delighted in humanity. Well, I'm pretty certain that God knows if, forgive the subjectivity of this, or the autobiography, but if he knows me from my mother's womb, if he knows me from the beginning of time, he knows what my talents are, my relationships, and he knows where I'm going to work out my discipleship, so it just happens to be there. But we all have the same framing.
Sure. Yeah, and I suppose that has kind of a point of contact with all of us in whatever areas we're in. You know, how many of us are going to be professional sports men or women, I don't know, but I know that we'll all go somewhere, and if Jesus Christ is number one for us, that will surely make a difference in everything we do.
I think that's the heart of Christianity, isn't it? It seems to me it's not just, I mean, it's absolutely vital. And one or two of the talks I'll be giving this week will be on this at different places that, in workplaces, when we do lunchtime things at workplaces. Well, there are two aspects to Christianity. One, God loves you so much that he would die for you, even when you're a rebel. So there's a freedom or a security in that, that you're loved, whether you succeed or fail in life, whether you're high or low. God loves you. And the cross has paid for it. But once that's established, there is a second point, which is, Paul writes in Ephesians 2:10, we are God's handiwork, created in Christ Jesus to do good works, which he prepared in advance for us to do. So if you trust that God knows all about you and would die for you and give you a new life, then he knows where you work. He knows your mum and dad and your best friends and your relatives. And he knows all that. And he's put you there. So once you're there, that's your vocation. And that's where he is at work in you. So a football club is some people's vocation. That's it.
Yeah, great. I want to do a couple other questions. We'll try and wrap up at 8 o'clock, if that's okay. So that's the plan. So the research we've talked about, can you just give us, I know we didn't have a very long pre-break, but outcome of the research, just kind of headlines.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll say one thing, then give the headlines, which is the result of this, the result of the research in a world of mental health, resilience, mindfulness, where everybody in professional sport and in everything else in life, it seems to be, is talking about it, is that the data we've got here, you can use. It's been a real joy, actually, as a Christian, to have done things with the Premier League and the Footballers Association, the Football Association, the Professional Footballers Union or Association, because there's very little written about the experience of professional footballers and their ability to cope with the game. So funnily enough, having done it as a Christian, it's meant doors have opened to talk about the things of the age, which is mental well-being, health and so on. The findings were pretty straightforward, really. I'll say it in a simple enough form. When you're a young footballer, you're promised the earth. That's it. If they want to sign you at 16, if you're really good at 14, 15, younger now, but back in the day, all the Premier League clubs would come to your home. Say in the 90s, all Premier League clubs would come to a boy who's playing for England schoolboys at 15. And they'd all offer mum and dad the earth. And they really would as well, like lots of money, to get the boy. Once the boy signs that form, the whole thing changes. So every footballer you interview, everybody fawns all over them. The moment they sign that form and go to work, bang, you better conform, son, or you're in all sorts of trouble. Now, these boys get injured. Hardly anyone makes it. Hardly anyone. If you sign for a Premier League club at 16, you leave school, 96% of those boys don't have a contract after 19. Of the boys who get a contract at 18/19, 92% never play a game for that team and are released at 21.
Wow.
And that's the best end.
Wow.
Right? So they promise you the world, but it can't deliver. And even for the one who becomes a superstar, they'll get injured or retire or somebody better will come along. So the first thing you find is if you know Christ personally, there's a security that the game can never offer you.
Amen.
Never. It can't offer you it. Wealth, fame, fortune, when it's smashed by injury and deselection and failure. So inside, there's a security that Christ gives that he gives to anyone who trusts him. But in that world, it's precious. Three things there are. Number two, once you know you're safe because Jesus loves you, whether you're injured or not, picked or not, once you know he loves you, an integrity develops. So sometimes in professional sport, men who I interview, they do things that are just wrong. Behavioral things, moral things. What goes on tour stays on tour. People misbehave. I collected loads of stories of people who had become a Christian and they were a senior player in their club. And the team were going off to do something that people shouldn't do. And the player would say, I'm not doing that. And they would get hammered by the teammates, by the older players. We all do it. We're all in. We're doing it together. And I didn't, you know, you don't advocate these stories. They come at you. You say, tell me what happened then when you became a Christian. What changed? You've told me about security when you had a cruciate ligament injury and how God helped you to really cope. You're more than a footballer. Socially, what happened? And people would say, oh, well, I said I'm not doing something really morally inappropriate. I got hammered for it. And then they'd say, but the thing was, a month later, 12 people out of 25 in the change room had come to me privately and said, Gav, thank you so much for refusing to do that thing that all the boys did. I hate doing it. I've got a girlfriend. I hate that behavior. I'm so glad you stood up. What gave you the guts to stand up? Is it your faith? So you move from something safe inside that makes you braver, morally sometimes, or often, which means that people look on, they say, there's something in this Christianity stuff, almost a witness. So all of them tell stories around that. So at the end of that, you can say with confidence to a Premier League conference, you can say, all I can tell you is these 15 elite top-level players, when they came to faith, one, they didn't lose they stayed in the game. They're very good players. Many of them now manage. And actually, you found that they were more resilient inside, more willing to practice what they preach, and felt better about themselves because they had the nerve to stand up for what they believed in, morally. And three, they made better teammates because they could be trusted. So you could say, I can just offer you that. Yes, they're Christians. And that may have something to do with it. But maybe you ought to find somebody to do more research to see what we know about this.
Yeah,
so that's what it shows.
Very, very interesting.
Oh, it's fab. Yeah. It's fab. You may know it, but until you can prove it in a secular culture, you may know these things are true, but data changes it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You write a paper on it, and people have to argue against your paper and prove you wrong.
Yeah.
Well, that's a different ball game then. Yeah. You're in a room on a different premise.
Yeah. It was interesting, we were talking just before about this is the 100th anniversary of Eric Liddell, who's the famous Christian sportsman who Olympic gold medalist who won the 400 yard dash in the Paris Olympics 100 years ago. It's Paris again this year.
Yes,
so
it is.
Kind of nice anniversary that year. And there was someone who lived for Christ in his sport and then stopped as a sportsman and went off to China to share Christ there. So.
Well, that famous quote of Liddell is the one in Chariots of Fire, isn't it?
Yes.
When I run, I feel God's pleasure.
Yes.
And sometimes, you know, our title tonight is good, but it's not from faith to football, is it? Because your faith's in school teaching, in college, in the school gate, in your family home. There's a God who knows everything, who knows us, and he's there with us in all of that.
Yes.
So the brilliant thing about Liddell, it is 100 years in Paris, that he couldn't run the 100, it was a Sunday, he didn't want to, he ran the 400 and won it. And by the way, if you ever do see footage of it, it's mad, because until he did that, he wasn't a 400-meter runner. And the most he ran was 200. And he ran the 200 at the pace that he always ran. And then everybody thought, he assumed he was just going to fall out and not last the course and drop. And he actually ran the second half as fast as the first half. So it was a madness what he did. But I think Lidl captures how a Christian should view any sporting gift they have. God is pleased when we are grateful to him for the talents we've been given, whether it's accounting or athletics. It's a gift. And God is full of joy at our talents. And he's full of joy at the relationships you get from competing in sport or from being at work with people and having neighbours. This is a joy. God has joy in that. So I love it when he says, when I run, I don't feel God's weight, or I don't feel the burden, or I don't have to win because people know my testimony, or I have to prove myself to be valuable. He says, I just know who made me fast. And when I run, I get joy in it.
Yeah.
It's a great approach to sport.
Yeah, fantastic. Listen, we've shot past 8 o'clock.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's fine. I think we probably do need to wrap up there, but...
Yeah.
Thank you so much for being willing to be in the hot seat and to answer questions. Thank you so much for asking questions. Sorry that we got only to a fraction of the questions.
No, I don't have a celebration
more
for a goal.
Coming in about
Why would I have a celebration for a goal when I never scored any? That's ridiculous.
That's a great
question. I love it. If I ever scored a goal.
Dano's here all week, so we can kind of ask him our personal little favourite questions on the list, which I didn't get to ask. So thank you so much for being with us. Why don't we show our appreciation to Graham?
Thanks.
Well, don't run away if you want to stay around. We're going to have some nice music in the background.